join us in the chat room, visit paltalk.com. Go to the social issues, select Other, and enter the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
Tune in to the Mind Cemetery with your hosts, Chip and Nicole, every Monday night at 9 p.m. Eastern.
Exclusively on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network. We delve into UFOs, abductions, ghosts, aliens, conspiracies, and cryptozoology.
And how could you ever forget about those creepy topics you won't hear on your local news?
This is where I would insert my obligatory skeptical statement. The Mind Cemetery, where the paranoia about the paranormal comes to rest.
Follow us on Twitter and subscribe to us on Facebook. Also, check us out on our website, mindcemetery.com, for show updates and the critically acclaimed Mind Cemetery blog.
It's not critically acclaimed, but you should check it out anyway, mindcemetery.com.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Benetti, and along with Joe Montaldo, we host News on the Flip Side. Come join us every Saturday night at 7 p.m. Central for our three-hour program. We have opinions on everything, and we're not afraid to share them. False history gets made all day, every day. The truth of the new is never on the news, but you can find it here with News on the Flip Side. Remember, don't be politically correct. Just be correct. Join us.
Tune in to UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Saturday nights at 11 p.m. Eastern on United Public Radio and UPRN 107.7 FM New Orleans, Louisiana, and 107.9 FM and 105.3 FM Henderson, Pass Christian, Mississippi. The show immediately follows News on the Flip Side, the flagship program of United Public. Tonight, Brunel and I have the honor of interviewing a gentleman named Bud, a cop from New Jersey, a veteran, a Native American, and a researcher and expert on Native American history, tradition, and culture. Koff also hosts a program called First Nations with co-host Black Hawk on the PNN News on Pal Talk, Wednesdays from 4 p.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern Time. Welcome to the program, Koff. Again, Vernell and I are so excited about learning of your Native American heritage and the importance of the contributions of the Native Americans to the American nation and American and world culture. Welcome again, Cobb. So happy to have you here.
Yeah. Watto, for me being here. Watto in Cherokee means thank you. I'd like to start out with, I want to bring you back to 40,000 years ago. It was the time when the Bering Straits up in Alaska was all landmass. And migration started taking place around 30,000 years ago. And they walked across into Canada. Now, picture Canada today and the USA, what it looks like. Well, back then, it wasn't called USA or Canada. There was three waves of migration that took place. And they went as far down to the Rockies, east of the Rockies. They landed up around Montana, Utah, Dakotas, all the Midwest up there. As they started migrating down, they all went different ways. Some went to the west for California, Washington, Oregon. Some traveled as far as Mexico. Some went down to Central America. And a lot stayed put in different areas like Arizona and what all the Midwest states. Now, bear in mind, the East Coast tribes on the East Coast from Florida all the way to Maine was not part of that migration at all. But there was a group of people from the migration time decided to travel a northeast direction from the mid in the middle of the United States, heading for New England states such as New Hampshire or Maine, Connecticut, up in there. But they went as far as Newfoundland. And how they found that out is because they matched, they found artifacts in Newfoundland that matches the Cherokee artifacts in North Carolina. So they were trying to piece that together there. They've been finding DNA artifacts 15,000 years old up toward Canada and Alaska that matches different things in the tribes of today in different areas. This is how the tribes came about. They all separated in different areas. Now, on your pencil and paper, I told you, the four key words would be money, greed, religion, and politics. And you put a big circle around it. That would be the four key words that everything revolves around later, hundreds of years later. Now, once they established tribes, they started having different names, and there's so many. As of today, there's 578 tribes. All the Native Americans has O positive blood, except for Hawaiians and Alaska. Now, they have a rare blood. When it comes to the blood, I would ask Joe for assistance, where he's an expert in different things. He had a show on blood one time, and he could try to pinpoint where the rare blood existed. But everybody had the O positive blood. My tribe is called the Calusa Nation. We're located in Florida. We lived on an island. The other name for it is called Shell People. The reason for that is because we all lived right on the Gulf side, and we lived off the seafood, and we took the shells, and we built our homes with, and everything else. We even used it for tools. We dug canals. The canals are still there. Of course, engineers, modern day, enlarged it. The canals we dug by tools and shells was only 6 feet deep, maybe about 15 feet wide, but real long. That would get you from one, just like you crossing the street, that we would take a canoe and row across or row down instead of getting in the car and going down the street. So we've been around for 30,000 years, but we're not a migration tribe. neither was the Cherokee or anybody on the East Coast there. Do you have any questions so far?
Do I remember correctly that there was a demise of the Calusa Nation as a thriving, ongoing Native American nation group? But there are survivors, but those survivors had to be adopted by other Native American nations. Am I correctly knowing
okay.
the situation?
Mm-hmm. Let me explain the course of what happened.
Yes.
We're the ones that banned Florida. We've been around there for so long. But in Florida, there was four other tribes, but they were on the Atlantic Ocean side, the east side. We were on the west side. When Spain came, they started fighting the Native Americans and trying to conquer them. But when it came around the Gulf and seen what we had, they thought, man, we're in heaven. So they started making peace, but then they started fighting us. Now, our Calusa men was 6 feet or over. They were like linebackers, big people. The women no more 5'2", 5'4". But it took Spain three times before they took us out. The way they took us out was not just fighting, but the diseases that the Europeans brought in. We got smallpox. We had, you name it, they brought it over. And this is what was dying off the tribes. Now, at the time, there's a tribe called Seminole. I'm part Seminole, too, because some of the Seminole merged into a group called the Seminoles, which means, in the Spanish word, means a wild man or runaway, which is made up with different tribes because they were escaping the force from the British and other people trying to kill the natives. So when the Seminoles were formed, other branches, other tribes merged in with them. One-third of the Calusa was taken as slaves. They used an island called the Bahamas as a slave trade thing. And they were trading one for one, one black for one Native American. A lot of them went to Cuba. If you took a DNA sample for people in Cuba, you'll find mostly two-thirds would be Native American blood in Cuba because their ancestors were slaves back into the 15th century, 16th, 17th, and so on. So when the Calusa merged in, they started fighting a war with the British. They were fighting them, and then later, like a couple hundred years later, then you had President Jackson. He was a general in the army. He went down there and tried three times to defeat the Seminoles. Some got captured and was forced marched to the Trail of Tears, which was an Indian Removal Act. And they removed all the Indians off their land and forced them out to Oklahoma and all. That's the Trail of Tears. And a lot of people died on the way. But there was 300 or 400 Seminoles ran back into the swamps and says, you're not going to take. So the army was sent down there to get them. But finally, they gave up. The United States said, no, we're spending too much money. Back then, it took them 5 generals and $10 million to try to defeat the Seminoles. And they never did. And they never signed a treaty to the U.S. government. And by rights, we're still at war with them. And this is how that started there. You know, we're moving up, you know, we're fast forward from 40,000 to 10,000 all the way up to the, you know, the 18th century. But I'm skipping, you know, a lot of years. But there was a lot of fighting between Jamestown in 1607, I believe, I forget the day, all the way to the 18th century. So this thing keeps on going and going and going. there's a lot of things I can talk about what they did to us, but that's later, you know, later down the road. And you heard of Pocahontas, right?
Yes, indeed.
Okay, Pocahontas was the daughter of a chief called Hamilton tribe. And she was, Pocahontas means mistress, not mistress, now I forget what it was, smiling face and something else, friendly and evil, is another word to put it. But growing up, people was taught that she married John Smith, which was untrue. The British lied to her, and later she married his friend, Rolfe, John Rolfe, I think, and they went to England. She turned out to be an ambassador for peace between the Native American tribe and England. But unfortunately, she died at age 22. And they never did make peace. And through the years, they tried to go over and get the remains of her, bring her back to her ancestors. They never did. They had a lot of red tape. They were getting into politics. But a lot of fighting had to do with greed, money, because they found gold in North Carolina and then tried to force people off. He found mineralites, food. So it just goes one thing after another, and this is how it worked. From the British, the French, and the Spaniards. So the Native Americans were fighting all three fronts. Do you have any more any questions?
No, I do. Some of that information that you've just relayed is truly fascinating. You know, Cobb, you had referenced to me a day or so ago a very interesting statement. That was that the Native American nations actually created the first type of constitution. And you were going to tell me which Native American nation first had a constitution and why you believe that our forefathers or founding fathers of the United States copied that constitution, at least in part.
Okay, up in, I believe it was Massachusetts, or up in the New England states, it was five tribes.
Yes.
And I forget the names of them, but they were at war with each other. I mean, they were battling out. And one chief, his family got killed, wife, kids, the whole bit. So he took off to figure out or think or regroup.
Yes.
And another Native American came up to him and says, I know what the problem is, let me help you. And let's call him a shaman. He got in a canoe with him, and they rode to the first tribe, and he sat there and made friends. And the one tribe agreed, okay, let's go to this tribe. And he went to all five tribes that was at war, and they all came together. When they came together, they said, okay, we need a representative for this. We need this. And you have no rights for this. They formed a constitution. And when they did that, and when you look at the constitution today, it's almost the same. It's a similar thing of what they did. Ben Franklin and Jefferson, well, Ben Franklin was the one that saw it. And he observed the way it was written down and the way it was operating. So they took that information, transferred it, and put it down in the Constitution. Of course, they added some more stuff to it. And this is how it came about. You know, I'll send you some more information on it. You know, I just don't have it handy on me.
That's fascinating. You know, when you were mentioning both the Indian Removal Act and the Trail of Tears, you had given me a website, and boy, I've enjoyed reading it today. It's entitled, it's by O. Ned, N-E-D, Eddins, E-D-D-I-N-S, and the article's entitled, The Indian Removal Act and the Trail of Tears. And you know, Mr. Eden's website is extensive and notes many aspects of the cultures and histories of the various Native American nations, but he's not as knowledgeable as you by any means, Cobb, but he cites an excellent one. I'm glad you referred me to it, and it can be reached at www.thefurtrapper.com. Again, www.thefurtrapper.com. And, you know, indeed, when you talk about money as being one of those key words, it seems that when the new American, the new residents from the European contact and the new American citizens found out that a particular territory or area did have significant resources, it was a bit of a catalyst for trying to urge the Native residents there, the Native American residents, to undertake a treaty or other arrangement whereby they left that area or ceded over control to the Americans or colonists at the time.
Yeah, this is where we get at on that. When it comes to mineral rights on the land, the white man's greedy forced them out and took the mineral rights. When it came to food, it's the same thing. They killed the natives just for the food and or the land, and it just kept on going and growing and getting bigger and bigger and bigger. It's just like, how many times can you force a person in a corner before they're going to react? They're going to react one way or another. So then the British were smart enough to make treaties to a couple tribes in Virginia, turned around and had the tribes fight other tribes. Now you got natives fighting natives because they were paying them off. Now if it wasn't money, it was other things, you know. So here the white man is tricking both the Native Americans plus the other side, you know, so they're going back and forth. You know, so they're sitting in the middle watching everybody else fight and get killed. As soon as they got killed, they took over. You know, they're thinking, why should I get my men killed? I'll pay these guys to go fight my battle. And while they're fighting, I'll come over and steal their food or steal their mineral rights and all this.
And that's a negative strategy, but can be a very effective one. And, you know, too, the information on the Cherokee is fascinating. From that article, I know you mentioned the Cherokee as well very much to me, where my uncle married a lovely lady who was one-eighth Cherokee. Anyway, in this article, the information on the Cherokee includes that, and here I'm quoting from the article, and that, of course, is the article by Oned Eddins. From his thefurtrapper.com website, here quoting, an influx of settlers following the discovery of gold near Dahlonega in northern Georgia brought Indian removal to a head, ellipsis. The state of Georgia wanted the Indians gone. To force the issue of states' rights with the federal government, Georgia passed a law in 1828 pronouncing all laws enacted through the Cherokee Constitution null and void after June 1st, 1830, end quote. So it doesn't sound too equitable, does it?
Yeah. This is our government for you. And in fact, they're starting the same stuff today in Arizona. You just don't read about it. And we'll get into that further down the road. They want to relocate the Navajo again, but this time it's not going to happen. Why? The Native Americans are college educated now. They're smarter, and they know how to work the system and beat them. That's the difference between, I'd say, 200 years ago to now. You know, they came a long way, but still we're on the bottom of the barrel. The Indian Removal Act, when it was passed, but the Supreme Court, if I'm not mistaken, said, no, you can't do it. But Jackson, as the president, he forced the army to go down there and remove them. Now, in the Cherokee, some decided to stay.
Yes.
Most left. So you have what they call an Eastern Band of Cherokee and a Western Band. By rights, they're brothers and sisters. You know, they're like family. You know, and they speak the same language, maybe a little different dialect, but they're still the same group, the same people like 200 years ago. Now, what that did, it caused friction between the two things now. You had a man named Ross, who was a representative of the Cherokee. He went to Washington to fight for the rights of the Cherokee. The same time, the Western Band had this guy, Wade, I believe, or I forget his name, Wade. He was so mad, he was going around killing soldiers and taking their food and wagon trains and all this. That's how bad it got. Then he came over this side to try to kill Rawson and people in the Eastern Band. So the government started a civil war between one tribe. That gives you an idea how bad it got.
And, you know, I hadn't realized as well, it's referenced in the article that Congressman Davy Crockett of Tennessee at the time did oppose the Indian Removal Act.
Yes, he did. And he went into Congress and kicked the doors in and everything else. He says, no, you can't do it. And he voted no. But when he looked around, the votes were already in. And he was like, a few people that voted no, and the rest just voted yes for it. And that was it. He lost. So he said, I'm out of here. You know? So he tried to warn the Cherokee what was coming to happen, but I don't know how far he got when he went down, you know, back down south. Because Davy Crockett came to Philadelphia before that vote was in, and he was giving a speech here. Because through my history, I got a few reports. But he was already in New England doing some lecturing and came down to Philly and told him about it. And then that's when he got the word and went down. So he was against the removal, but it didn't work out that way.
Well, that's an interesting vignette. And, you know, here I'm going to further quote the article because I just found it so interesting, citing Chief Justice John Marshall ruled that the Cherokee Nation was sovereign, making the removal laws invalid. The court ruling meant the only way the federal government could remove any tribes was with a formal treaty. With President Andrew Jackson refusing to uphold the Supreme Court decision, the Cherokee were divided and despondent, end quote. You know, that is just incredible. I'm amazed. And, you know, on the subject of law, I really find it very, very fascinating that the Native American tribal governance system remains thriving, and it does contain its own judicial and legal format. It's studied in law schools, Native American tribal legal system, and I think that's fascinating. I really do.
It is. We have our own laws compared to what they call the white man's law in a lot. Give you an example. You see how a police officer needs a search warrant to do things? Well, on a res, you don't. Because a lot of reservations are bad today. And they don't have time to go all this red tape. They don't do that no more. They never did it. They're going after somebody on the reservation. They're going to get them one way or another. I mean, they don't really use deadly force unless they have to, but most of the time, they get their suspect on the res, because where are you going to run? You can surround the whole place with people, and there's only one way in and one way out. Or you want to climb a mountain and go on the other side, you're going to get caught. But usually they get them. But through the history, a lot of British or a lot of white men hired the Native Americans and put a badge on them and say, okay, you know, stay on the res and cool things down and report to me anything bad activity. So some of them were deputized, you know, being a deputy here and a deputy there, and the tribal members didn't like it, you know, because they were calling them traitors. So now you got more people infiltrating the tribes and wanted to know what was going on. And anything that happened, they would go after them. But there was so much manslaughter and killing of the Native Americans that what you see today over in the Mideast is what happened to us since 1492 to 1800. In fact, the longest war the U.S. was ever involved in was 60 years long, and that was the U.S. government versus the Native American Indians, 1833, I believe, to 1893, something in that order, a couple years, maybe after or before that, but it lasted 60 years. That's a long time, and that's every war, constantly, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It could be in Georgia, it could be in Tennessee, it could be in Florida, it could be New England states, it could be anywhere. They were constantly fighting the Native Americans. And there was over 15 million of us through the United States back then. Yeah, they reduced it down to about, right now I think the population's about 2 million, I believe. I'm not sure. I have to check that out. But this goes back as far as George Washington. All the forefathers there wanted to get rid of us. And it was a proven fact because they found it in the archives. And that was really shocking. I never knew he did it, but I knew even Abraham Lincoln. He hung Native Americans. You don't read about that. In fact, if you open up a history book in high school, two-thirds of the history book is lies. There's two sides of the story, we call it the white man's side or winner's side, the winners, or you have the other side, the Indian side, which is the losers, and you don't hear about it. Show me a book about losers in history. You don't. All you see is winners, and you don't hear about the Indian side, what they did to us. All you hear is about Custer this or that, somebody who was a hero. Well, wait a minute. You can't have a hero without another hero. And finally, slowly but surely, it's coming out. But it's taken all this time, you know. You got any more beginning questions?
Well, that's one massive engagement. And, you know, referencing again some of the history. Now, in that article, it mentions that this is a segment where they discuss the Cherokee and after they arrived in Oklahoma and during the Trail of Tears.
Citing directly, the federal
government gave large land grants
to the
various
Indians in their lifetime.
As an inducement to the Indian territory. With America's western expansion and the discovery of oil in the Oklahoma Territory, the federal government wanted back millions of acres of Indian land. The redistribution of land was accomplished through the Dawes, D-A-W-E-S, Dawes Act of 1887. The Dawes Act took away communal tribal holdings in favor of individual allotments, usually 160 acres. By the beginning of the 1900s, the vast majority of the land given to America's first inhabitants under the Indian Removal Act did not belong to the American Indians. And further quoting, in addition to taking away tribal lands, the Dawes Act established a trust fund for the proceeds from oil, mineral, timber, and grazing leases on Native American lands. Poor management by the Bureau of Indian Affairs bureaucrats led to lawsuits in the 1990s and early 2000s, which forced the federal government to account for the money collected by the Bureau of Indian Affairs Indian Trust Fund. Billions of dollars were returned to the trust fund, end quote. Well, those are very interesting developments, and that certainly does apply to your four words as well.
Well, see, here we go again on that key word, money. A lot of money has disappeared through the years. Because it was supposed, a lot of money even today is supposed to go to the people and help them out. But there's a lot of stealing going on, this going on, just like Washington, as we know, and everybody's pointing fingers. So now we're getting into money and politics. Because the BIA, as far as I'm concerned, is just like Washington, D.C., Obama, and all them people, because they get money off the government to pay the people on the reservations. Well, when you go and look where the money's going, by the time it gets down to, let's say, a cancel, well, half that money's gone. But where'd it go? So somebody's taking money that's not feeding the people. Look at Pine Ridge today. They need help. Look at Arizona. Look at all the reservations around. Somebody in between Washington and the reservations taking half that money. And I have no clue where it is. I've been trying to figure it out.
Man, when I got shingles,
friends on
it was something else.
And,
it was
and they
like
don't know.
Being blindsided.
You know, this is why they ask for donations. Things like this.
And back.
So now we're getting back. That was one of the key words they said, put a circle around them words. You know, as I said, you know, money, greed, politics, and religion. And another thing that the white man did is took all the kids from the parents and forced them into boarding schools. And forced them not to teach, talk their native language. Cut their hair, redress them, and everything else. Which, they forced them back in the 18th century.
Is already in.
And there were schools up here in Pennsylvania, Virginia. All over the place, forcing them. And you could be on a reservation out west. I ran up in Pennsylvania here. So that's another hardship that they went through.
Now, I'm not telling this.
But all the money's not going to the reservations. I can prove that. Any more questions?
That's a very important point. And, you know, not only are the Native American languages important for cultural purposes to be preserved, it's their legacy, and also the legacy of the American nation. But think of the great work that the Navajo Code Talkers did in World War II, devising that brilliant code to make sure that our American military communication was secure. Am I correct? The Japanese never could decipher that code.
Okay, that's true. I knew the, I met the Navajo, the original Navajo Code Talkers. The last one died a few months back. But there were still some still living today that like the second part. The Navajo, when they got started, people thought, oh, they're the ones that started it. It's not so. In World War One, I believe it was, in a battle or after a battle, there was two Native Americans sitting around a tree. One was Seminole and one was Cree, and they were talking in their language. And the lieutenant happened to go by and stop and said, what are you talking? What kind of language is that? And he said, oh, we're talking our Native American language. Well, guess what? Those two guys said, the lieutenant says, come on, you're going with me. You're no longer in the infantry. You're going to be on the radio. And this is how the code talkers started. Then when World War II broke out, they knew about it, but they didn't force it until they started getting heavy losses and then formed the Navajo. But it wasn't just the Navajo. It was the total of 33 tribes entered World War II, I believe it was. But over in Europe, you had the Comanches. You had the Apaches. You had the Seminoles. You know, you had different groups over there. Over in the other side, the Pacific Theater, you had the Navajo, you had the Pima, the Hopi, you had different tribes there. But the Navajo was made up of one group, and then another code talkers would be, let's say, the Hopi. But all you're hearing about is the Navajo because there were more of them. They helped win the war. But the credit should go to every one of those code talkers and different Native Americans, but people don't realize that because they're so used to hearing Navajo all the time. If you met a Navajo code talker and you were in the Marines like I was, and you meet him, and I would say, Semper Fi, he knew who you were. Now he's an elder. The elder, you wait for the elder to talk. You don't say a word until he looks at you and say, sit down. And then he would ask you the questions. And then that's what he did to me. Once I answered the questions correctly, then it was an honor for me to talk. But I did not, when I met him, I did not bring up the war because we're sick and tired of it at the time. I let him bring something up, and then I would bring something up. And this is how we communicate. And then after a while, I got good friends, and every time I went to Arizona, first thing I did was I visit the elders and gave them a gift, and vice versa. And this is how it started. But the Navajo is the key figure in the Pacific theater. Then comes the Hopi and everything else.
Well, that's interesting information. And, Cobb, thank you so very, very much for your military service. And, you know, Cobb, the Native American nations are very bright peoples. They're creating business developments such as casinos and tourist locations. There really is much to be learned from the Native American archaeological sites as well, and their system, again, of governance, agriculture, innovative ecology principles, hunting, community development, and so forth. Many contributions.
That's true. See, when they start something on their land, like a casino, automatically, you know how the government is. They want to get their 2 cents in.
Yes.
They speak up and say, you can't touch me. I'm a sovereign nation. So what they'll do is they'll send a spy in to look around the casino, see how it's played. They'll come back and report to the government. And
right.
Suppose you're in a casino there and you win big. You walk out that door and come off that Indian land, guess who's greeting you? The IRS or the government. So they're trying to do sneaky stuff, but you don't read about all that.
And you know, if you hear newspapers here being opened, I'm trying to find this article. It was in Arizona Republic Today, ArizonaRepublic.com, and the Arizona Republic was mentioning how the casinos now are readying for the Arizona hosting of the Super Bowl. So many of them, and they're very thriving concerns, and they're very much prepared to greet the public. And God bless them for utilizing their business acumen to be so successful.
Yeah, see, when they start doing that, they have to get approval by the council of the tribe.
Mm-hmm.
They can't just say, all right, I want to do this. They can't. It has to be approved. And it's up to the chief. But remember something about Native American tribes. Just because you have a chief, he's not the one that's giving orders all the time. The women puts down the laws. Passes the laws down to the chief, then the chief enforces them. A lot of people think, all right, the chief is doing this or the chief is doing that. Yeah, but where is he getting all this laws at? It's because the women, like Wilma Mancor, she was a leader of the Cherokee Nation in the Western Band, but she represented everybody, and the government was actually afraid of her. She passed away, but there's another woman that took her place. So the women is the one that's really doing all this and then passing everything down. So they got to make real hard decisions. And plus, remember, today is the 21st century. They're more educated now than they were 100 years ago or 50 years ago. So they know a little bit more how the ball is playing and ran between the government. And there is.
Boy, that's interesting. And you know, Cobb, earlier, Bud, earlier in the show tonight, you had mentioned an ongoing, significant controversy between the Navajo and another party regarding resources. Was that by any chance? I just found out at a site called Cultural Survival, culturalsurvival.org, and reading directly. As of January 1st, 2006, one of the most contentious U.S. coal mining operations, the Black Mesa Mine on Hopi and Navajo reservations in northeastern Arizona, will close. This action is due in part to resolutions passed by the Navajo and Hopi tribal councils to prohibit the use of the Navajo aquifer to transport coal and to the slated closing of the Mojave Generating Station for environmental violations, end quote. Is there any connection there with that ongoing current controversy?
Yes, there is. Mm-hmm. In fact, if you want to write down this, it's on the YouTube. It was filmed, and it's on YouTube. They put it on. It's called Broken Rainbow, mm-hmm. Part 1 to Part 7.
Uh-huh.
It's a company called Peabody that's up there in the northeastern Arizona or northwestern. It's up there where the Navajo is, part of the res. They have barbed wire across the borderline. They want to relocate the Navajo because they got minerals on that ground. Plus, the other side, as you mentioned, it was a coal thing, and they shut it down because it's contaminated the water. So now it's a big draw-out thing. This time, they're not going to relocate the people on the res, even in Navajo, because 578 tribes, representatives, let's say five people apiece, showed up. This time, they got guns pointing at each other. And, you know, if somebody makes the wrong move, it's going to be a wounded knee all over, but it ain't going to be the Native Americans going to get wiped out this time. See, there was a history about the wounded knee after Custard, where the army killed women and children and all. And then there was another wounded knee in 1973, and that went down. They brought in the Sherman tanks and everything else to remove them. But this time, there's a lot of veterans, Native American veterans, and they know how to take out people. But now they're just talking right now. I don't know what's going to happen. I haven't heard any news on that yet. But if you look at that, Broken Rainbow, that would give you an idea of what's going on today. They want to move a lot of Native Americans just to get that mineral and get things moving. You know, you just don't read about it.
That sounds very important news, though, a very, very important ongoing development. You know, I'm kind of throwing this question out. I want to very much mention the Lakota. You know, I spent about 3 years in Colorado, beautiful, beautiful state, with a loved one there. I noticed the term Arapaho, and you mentioned to me that was a Native American nation, often used for, you know, any type of such an inn, a apartment building, commercial building. It was a really very popular adjective in Colorado. Now, let's see. It says here, just from researching, that they formerly inhabited eastern Colorado and southeast Wyoming. Was there a treaty involving the Arapaho? Were they relocated? I don't know. I'm a little bit confused as to their present status. Are they still in Colorado?
Most of them, all the tribes had a treaty. Every tribe except for the Seminoles. There was, I think, 3,200 and some odd treaties, but every one was broke. And every Native American was moved one way or another. They're supposed to be in, if they're not in Colorado, that means they had to be moved down to toward Oklahoma or up or toward Utah, somewhere up in there. But I'm not sure. I know there's a couple of reservations there in Colorado, but I'm offhand, I forget the names of them. But every one was moved one way or another, and every treaty was broken. That's another thing. Because the white man broke all this and broke every one of them, you know. And they even do it today. You just don't read about all this stuff.
Well, you know, to the reason I mentioned that as well, I thought I had read the name, the tribal nation Arapaho, it was the commissary up at the Fort Warren, Wyoming, I believe, and they were mentioning they were sort of celebrating the Native American presence in that area, both historically and currently, and I thought they had like a little, it was just a representation historic events there. I thought I heard some type of treaty referenced on that, but that's very, very interesting treaty information. Kok, could you mention now the importance of the great Lakota Nation?
Okay, the Lakota was actually the Sioux, and it's broken down into three groups, Lakota, Nakota, and Dakota. It comes under the Seven Council Fires. Dakota mm-hmm. has three Council Fires. Dakota has three, and Lakota has one Council Fire. But actually, they were called the Sioux at one time. They're the ones with the Cheyenne helped defeat Custer. Next door to them, you would have the Crow Nation. The Crow Nation and the Sioux were enemies at one time. The Crow had scouts scouting for Custer. And when they came, they knew what was going to happen, so they did a chant. And then the Custer at one time said, get them out of here. And then you know what happened to Custer. But later, that's when you had Wounded Knee, when they rounded up the women and children and started forced marching them. And it was in the wintertime, and they just shot every one. There was a few survivors that hid. I forget her name now, but she hid behind a bush. And once they left, she ran back and started hiking. And she was wounded, but she made it back and told the tribe what happened, and that helped defeat the Sioux and all. So then when the word got back to Washington, and all fireworks happened, so the general or whoever was in charge supposedly got court-martialed. But what made everybody mad even today, they were giving out the Medal of Honor to the soldiers who killed women and children. And that really makes people mad today, even just thinking about it, you know, and it just keeps on going, you know. But yet, the Native Americans fought in every war the U.S. was ever involved in, more than the whites, the blacks, the Hispanics, the Latinos, and all put together. But yet, this is how we got treated from way back up. All this stopped around 1893.
Boy, very, very powerful facts there. And, you know, this is a bit off on a tangent, but I know we've discussed this before. When I was in Colorado, I remember seeing one herd of buffalo. They were located in Longmont en route to Lyons, or vice versa, depending on the direction there. Magnificent herd. I think they were temporarily placed there, but you could see them. I think we saw them 2 years in a row. Magnificent beings, creatures. Do the buffaloes still hold a tremendous symbolic meaning to even more Native American nations and peoples?
Yeah, the white buffalo is the sacred buffalo for the Lakota. And there was a couple born, and let me tell you something, they had armed guards around that thing because people knew what it meant. And one buffalo, I think, down toward Texas was stolen or killed, but the other one that was born was taken up to the Dakotas. It's a sacred thing where later it said, it meant we will come back strong, and it's a sacred thing, just like the medicine wheel. Do you know anything about the medicine wheel?
No.
Okay. It has four colors on it. The medicine wheel is like a circle with lines. It looks like if you look at it, it looks like one of them hippie things, like a Y, but it has colors in it, four directions. And also, it means the four types of people on Earth. Okay, you have the black, which is the black people from the South. And then you have the yellow, which is the Asian people. Then you have the red for us, and then you have the white. That's the colors. It also means the four seasons. You know, the white for snow, the black for thunderstorms, you know, one for the spring and summer. Okay, that's what the medicine wheel stands for. And you'll see it in the Lakota and everything. And they go by it. They also go by harmony, which I've been studying harmony for a while. And the difference between a Native American and other people is we talk to animals when we talk to plants. You know, we know different things. But a regular person doesn't do all that. And if you can get back into harmony, you'll have less stress. And it works, you know. And this is why, if you go out in the woods and you listen to sounds and you're into harmony, you can actually tell the difference between a bear walking at a distance or a deer walking or a squirrel or a rabbit. You can almost identify that just by the sounds. And that's getting into harmony. You know, and then you look at the birds. Before a rainstorm, you see a bunch of birds in a flock. When you see that, that means you're going to have a storm, rain, or snow, or whatever, because they get together. So animals talk back to you in different ways. Now, if you ever see a dog, I mean, I know you've seen a dog, but you ever see a dog running, stopping, looking around? What he's doing, he's looking around, not because he's exercising. He's looking for danger, just like a wolf. A wolf would run through the field and stop, look around, have nothing there, then he'll continue. That's part of the wildness of a wolf and a dog. Also, a dog, you ever watch before he lays down, he walks around a circle in a while, then he lays down. The reason for that is because a wolf does the same thing. What they're doing is packing the dirt or the grass down so they can lay down in that spot. So that's part of the wildness of an animal. This is how you learn different things on animals and harmony.
Boy, that is really very, very intriguing. Well, you know, I believe that the Native American nations would have much to teach us as well on important ecology principles, particularly now when you think of, well, the harm that's been caused the country by misuse of resources and mining of them, also with the tremendous droughts now that the West is facing. I think that their help would be absolutely indispensable. And also, you know, I don't want to shoot this other question off, but, you know, I was thinking about it all day today. I had a dear friend in school who was applying to be a JAG attorney. My guess is she became a JAG attorney for the U.S. Marine branch of the military. She was an Iroquois, though, from the state of New York. The Iroquois people are hopefully still thriving up there.
Yeah, they sure are. In fact, that singer, I'm trying to think of her name, Joanne Shenandoah, I believe she was Iroquois, Six Nation, I believe. Yeah, they're up in New York, and some of them are in Canada, you know. So they're doing pretty good. I mean, they know, they have a casino up there, too. I'm trying to think where the town is. It's near Buffalo. It's an Oneida reservation up there in New York. They have a casino. And the Iroquois is like from there and up in New York. I mean, Canada, too.
Yeah,
but it's good to know different things on the Americans, you know. It's because we can teach a lot, but people just don't listen. If you want to know a lot of true facts about the Native Americans, how I learned it from the elders. And these elders are 80 years old. You sit in a circle with them, and they'll talk all day, and you learn the facts. And even my father told me about my family, the Calusa, and my grandmother did when I was younger. Well, when you're a young boy, and you're down the shore listening to her, you want to go out and play and go swimming. You know, but my grandmother used to take me down the shore, down on the beach, and pick up seashells and say to me, listen to the air, listen to the ocean. And then being 8, 9 years old, you know, you really didn't think about much. But then, later, then I realized what she meant. And my friend says, well, you're a sea turtle. You know, they used to tease me because I always ran to the ocean. And I couldn't figure out, okay, I'm a sea turtle. I laughed about it. But when I went up to a shoreman and asked him, why is I'm being called a sea turtle? And he turned around and laughed a little. He said, that's an honor. And he said, number one, you're going to live a long life. And two, you got the wisdom, he said. And then I thought about that. Here next month, my dad is 98 years old, and he's Calusa too. And so it's like it all rubs in one circle.
Well, you know, I just found something that I thought would might be very helpful to our listening audience as well. And indeed, I found this information very informative and helpful for me, for my own knowledge about the importance of the Native American nations. And indeed, this was Off the Grid. It's a website, Off the Grid News. It's an article entitled, What Native Americans Can Teach Us About Sustainability. Boy, it sounds wonderful. And let me see. Just quoting the first paragraph, we know that the earth and all of creation came into being by God as designer and creator. We know that God intended for our planet to be inhabited and thus put in place a number of finely tuned systems, cycles, and physical parameters that sustain life, end quote. And this is a Christian perspective here. I'm quoting directly again. While Christians should in no way abandon the mandates given to us in the Bible, there is much to learn about caring for the land from those who don't necessarily believe the same as we do, specifically the Native American people. Europeans who arrived in Europe must have thought that the fertile, well-managed land just happened to be. They knew that Native people existed, but did not give credit to their skills or knowledge. Because of this, they missed the opportunity to learn about a highly complex and sustainable form of earth management. In fact, this form of land management was one of the most sophisticated that has ever existed, end quote. And this is from the article, What Native Americans Can Teach Us About Sustainability, from offthegridnews.com. Very worthwhile article, dated August 18th, 2014, from this summer.
Well, here you're starting back on every tribe can teach people something. From survival to health to harmony, but people of today don't listen. One of the reasons they don't listen is because they're always in a rush. They don't take their time. If they took their time and observed your surroundings and knew what's going on, I put politics on the side. This, you know, and put money on the side. But let's get into your health. A lot of people get heart attacks because of stress level, this or that. But on the other hand, if you did a steady pace and ate certain foods, your stress level would be low. You know, a lot of Native Americans, they're diabetics, you know, diabetics, I mean, because of the lack of food. But they have ways to try to cure it. And if it got real worse, then they would go see a diabetic doctor or something like this. But there's other elders I talk to, they're about as healthy as anything because they eat the right foods. And all they have to do is just teach other people how to do things. But here again, let's now throw in the money. Pharmaceutical companies and all this that's going to, they go and get copy off us Indians about stuff and go and make money on it. Instead of sharing it. And this is the problem where they won't share no more to a lot of people because of the big business. I'll give you an example. Out in South Dakota, I believe it was, Lakota owned some land. And on the land had these flowers. So this company came over and gave the Lakota money, the money over to them to buy this land. He went on that land and picked every flower there was. And then he left and said, hey, you can have the land back. Here's your title. All they wanted was the flower. Why? Because they knew that flower was making medicine and making billions of dollars. Well, they left a few plants left over. You know, they didn't see. Now the whole field is grown with them. Now they want it back. They want the flowers. Lakota says, nope, you did the first time, but not now. You're not getting it. So that's another battle they're doing. You know? So that gives you an idea where people stand between the big businesses and the culture. Because they're not sharing. We don't mind sharing, but share it to the right people. And don't sit there and take it and make money and don't get something back.
You know, those are very, very powerful arguments. And, you know, the Native American people whom I've met here in Arizona, as well as my Iroquois friend there, whom I knew at the school in Oklahoma, are very bright people, very, very capable. I'm hoping that not only are they pursuing all of the academic degrees here in the United States, but also preserving their native language as well. What have you heard about this? Are the young Native American generations being taught their languages? And also, I hope that the government is affording them many scholarships to schools. They certainly deserve them.
The young generation today are losing most of their culture. They're losing their language. They're losing the means of life. They're losing a lot because they're being forced into the other side of the world. I mean, there's nothing wrong with learning more and more and more, but why don't you learn both as you grow up? You know, have dual things. You know your language, you know, you learn English. You learn your culture, learn the white man's culture. So you're going back and forth. There's nothing wrong with that. But no, it's slowly, the young generation's being actually forced into the other side and forget about their side. And especially the economy. When there's no jobs, then that's when you got the drugs and the liquor and the booze and all that. They called it back then fire water. And there's a lot of drugs on the reservation. You know, they get it from the outside and bring it in. In fact, just the other day, yesterday, down in Arizona, in Apache, there was a suicide. Somebody OD'd on drugs. And then it was a month before a Native American took a weapon out and started shooting up the casino. You didn't read all about that, but it happened, you know. So there's a lot of problems on the reservations. But yet the newspaper doesn't put it out and tell you about it. You know, and in fact, it's good in one way because why broadcast it? It happens every day, but it's a shame it happened on a Native American res. You know, and it's all because of drugs, though, and all that. There's more drugs scattered through the Indian reservation for no jobs, no nothing, and I mean, it's just getting worse and worse and worse. You know? And the government ain't helping. Nobody's helping. That's why, like, I'll get stuff and send it out to the Indian reservation, building materials extra I got or whatever. But I don't see people helping. And then they just walk away like it's nothing. And then when you come into religion, back in the 18th century, 17th century, the British colonials, England, try to practice their religion into the tribes. Well, guess what? That's a no-no. You know, some today are converted into Christianity, but some ain't. And when you say God here, you know, God, but we had the Creator. Or we have Wakatanka, which is the Great Spirit. It's all one. But our beliefs in one way, spirituality, the other one sitting in the church with a Bible, you know, listen to somebody talk. There's a difference. But yet, we do it, we're either outside in the circle or out there somewhere. And we do our sacred dances. And the sacred dances, was that President Carter signed a bill when he was president to allow the Native Americans to do sacred religion dances. They took it, the government took it away from us many years ago, hundreds of years ago. And then finally Carter put it back. So there it gives you an idea how they're trying to force religion on the Native Americans. So that's another black mark against the white people. So this thing can go on and on and on. All the stuff that I know, we sure ain't going to cover like in 2 hours, because I could go on for hours and days and days and days, you know. But I can keep on going when you're ready on other things. Because
absolutely,
there's a lot of graphic stuff, Chris, you know.
Well, I'd love to have you as a return guest. Cop, I've learned so much this evening. And I hope you'll honor us with being a return guest.
Yeah, it'd be my honor. And I'll bring in Blackhawk or a Kuala Cherokee. Kuala Cherokee comes from a lost tribe in the Cherokee Nation. And he's smack on the borderline. He's a sovereign nation. And I think Joe would know if he's part Cherokee up there between Carolinas and somewhere up in there, up in the high mountains. I'm not from over the area. But there was a lost tribe that was there for years and years, and nobody knew about it. Until one day a bunch of hikers came across it, and that's where Kuala Cherokee was born at and raised there. And he lives now in Montana, but he knows everything about politics on that. And Black Hawk, he's a shaman. He's a friend of mine from Arkansas. He's Cherokee. I could get him on online, too. You'll enjoy what he has to say.
Well, we so appreciate Cop, your visiting us. I learned so much, and you know, Bud, again, thank you for your your military service, for being a veteran of the United States Marines, also for your excellent research on Native American history, tradition, and culture, and also I forgot to mention your wonderful service as a policeman in New Jersey and with other law enforcement services. God bless you, sir.
Yeah, thank you very much. You know, I left the department 2 years ago, which I'm glad, you know, because all the stuff that's happening now, I don't want to be in between a gunfight. Maybe I still hike 10 miles, but I don't think I can run 10 miles chasing somebody. Yeah. I wonder if Joe's still on the line, do you know? I got to ask him about the blood type.
Let me see. Wait 1 second. Let me just have a note in text here.
Yeah, when I talked about you about the blood type, I got to find out how old the negative blood has been around.
Mm. Indeed, I know Kevin's writing in. Kevin, yeah. Now, Kevin, I forget. You're from Oregon, correct? What a wonderful listener he is. A gentleman named by the name of Kevin is saying, great show, Therese and Cop. Washington, I'm sorry, Kevin. You know, I am getting older. Kevin is our listener from the beautiful state of Washington, and he's commending you on an excellent show there, Cop. Lots of very informative, very intriguing information, excellent information. Now, let's see. You're talking about the blood types and abductions.
Because when I mentioned about the blood types, about Native Americans having O positive, and only Alaska and Hawaiian has the rare blood. Well, back then when he mentioned about, he had a show on blood, but he mentioned something about the rare blood, the negative, how old it is. So I was trying to piece that together in my mind on the migration. If I can piece that together, I just might have a bit more new information. I'm just trying to figure something out. It's dawned on me tonight. So suppose the negative blood is 30,000 years old. Let's say that. And the migration took place 30,000 years ago. So somewhere in Tibet or Mongolia, somebody had the blood that stayed in Alaska. Okay, or somebody went to Hawaii, but everybody else had O blood. That's what I'm trying to figure out, when I was mentioning. So, I catch Joe next time if he's sneaking on the job.
That's very interesting. You know, I'm typing in text now. Quick comment. I live here in the western section of Phoenix, and there is a very large Hispanic community. Now, the individuals with Incan and Mayan heritage, they too would have been part of that tremendous migration, but it would have been centuries afterwards or years afterwards from the first groups entering from the Bering Strait passage over to the western continent, the western North American continent?
I believe so, because they did find some artifacts down there where the Mayans were that equal the some of the artifacts equal up toward Canada up that way when they traveled down. They used what they call ground-penetrating radar. That's how they found some of this stuff. And when they did a match, they found stuff from all over. You know, in fact, they found a statue, looked like a mummy, 18 inches long in a cave. They also came across in Arizona in a cave, engravings on a wall that looked like a spaceship and a spaceman. So some tribes think we come from the star people. So here we go. Other people see, you know, UFOs or ETs maybe and think that we came from there. You know, so there's a lot of questions still, but not enough answers. You're still working on it.
Well, you know, Cobb, again, thank you so much. I really enjoyed this discussion. And, you know, Cobb, again, please promise to be a return guest.
Yeah, no problem.
And again, another shout-out to that the program, Wednesdays, 4 to 5 p.m. Eastern, correct, on PAL Talk, the PNN Newsroom?
Yeah, Wednesday at 4 p.m. to 5 o'clock p.m. Eastern Standard Time, Lau Colt and I host his First Nation show. And we're so deeply involved, though, that we've got... I'm up to the 16th century, while Blackhawk is actually, he went from introduction to raising the family. Here's something that I learned of Russell Means. This is still in my head. Men are in diapers when we're young, when we're born, and men is in diapers when we're an elder. We need a mother or a woman to take care of us when we're a baby growing up. We need a woman or a wife or someone there to take care of us when we're an elder, okay? But a woman, she doesn't need diapers. She grows into a flower. The next stage, another flower. And the next stage, more beautiful flower. And on and on and on. Our job as a man is problem solvers. While the woman's job is children, nurturing, taking care, feeding the family, all the way down the line. This is the Native American way and the wisdom. And Russell Means said that, and it really, and it's part of the circle of life. There you go.
Well, again, a great point there. And, thank you again so much, Cobb. It was a pleasure to interview you. Can't wait to invite you to be a further guest to learn more information, updates to on those current developments, including with the Navajo. Great evening to you, Cobb, and weekend, and wonderful evening weekend to our listeners. Thank you for joining us. We really appreciate the time spent. And Cobb, we really appreciated your time as well this evening. Great information. Good night, everyone.
Yeah, good night. Thank you. Bye-bye.